milestone day for AMD. The company has closed on its $35 billion deal for Xilinx. The acquisition is seen boosting AMD's efforts in computer processors used in data centers and wireless networks. Joining us now is AMD CEO, Dr. Lisa Su. Lisa, always nice to see you. Congrats on closing this deal. It's been a long time coming. You originally announced it in October 2020. For investors not familiar with the company, what does this allow you to do?
Yeah, Brian, thank you so much for having us this morning. It's a very, very exciting day for us. I'm actually talking to you from the Xilinx campus. We're just about getting ready to welcome our new 5,000 wonderful employees. So look, AMD has always been about high performance computing. And, you know, our vision of the world is that you need all types of computing to really serve customers and really think about what's next in the industry. So adding Xilinx is an incredible company. They've done extraordinarily well as a standalone company. Actually, both companies have done extremely well. But putting our two companies together is really a complementary set of markets, customers, and products. And so we're extremely excited about doing it. And as you said, it's been about 16 months, but we've been planning and we're absolutely ready to have a fast start on day one.
Lisa, what's going to be your message to those 5,000 Xilinx employees?
Well, I think our message is, you know, again, two wonderful teams, two of the best teams in the industry coming together. One plus one is going to be much greater than three. And it really is, you know, across, we're all about products, as you know, Brian. So building great products, ensuring that we continue to deepen our customer relationships across the board, and really, continue to build upon the great growth franchise that we have already built with AMD and Xilinx separately.
And to your point, you've had a lot of time, a lot of opportunity to plan out this integration. So now that the day is here, what are your first three top priorities here?
Well, there's a lot of excitement across our customer set as well as across the industry. And when we think about, you know, the benefits of bringing the two companies together, again, for customers, it's about a much broader product portfolio, right? We now have, you know, CPUs, GPUs, FPGAs, adaptive SoCs, ASIC capability that can go across the most important markets in the world. So, you know, the data center market, you know, the strategic assets that we have for the data center market, the communications market, where Xilinx is extremely strong. And, AMD has assets that can work in those areas, industrial, automotive. All of these markets need this collection of capabilities that we have. And we're going to be able to offer that entire portfolio to our customers, as well as build some really amazing and innovative products.
When you have been able to talk to customers over the past 6 months and just going through this integration process, not the integration process, just the planning process, what are you hearing from your customers? And do you sense a big pickup in business now that you've closed this deal?
You know, we do sense, Brian, a lot of excitement for what we can do as a combined company. And when you think about, you know, some of our largest customers, the cloud customers, you know, what they're looking at is, you know, really, you know, what do you need for the next five plus years? We've had tremendous success across, these large customers with our, CPU portfolio and our GPU portfolio. I think adding Xilinx adds some strategic assets, things like networking technology, which is very important for the data center business, adaptive SoCs, AI. We're really excited about enhancing our AI capabilities as a joint company. Those are some of the things that we talk to customers about. And I think, you know, really the sky's the limit in what we can do together. When you have such talented team, I mean, we'll have over 15,000 of the best engineers, in the semiconductor industry. So it's just an incredible team that we're bringing together.
I think it was 24 months ago, Lisa, where you outlined, it was an investor day, outlined 20% compound annual growth rate for AMD. Now that was before Xilinx. How fast is your company growing now that the deal's done?
Well, you know, we're looking forward to updating our financial model, Brian, in the coming month. But what I'll tell you is, you know, this acquisition is accretive in the first year for gross margins, for earnings per share, for free cash flow. So it's a very good deal overall. And when we look at growth rates, you know, what we said at the time of acquisition is that we felt we could grow significantly ahead of the industry, 20% plus CAGR for the next few years. And we still believe that that's the case. And we are going to update our financial model shortly But overall, you know, both from a financial standpoint, a technology standpoint, and a customer standpoint, we think there are a lot of positives for us as we come together.
What is the state of the market right now? And you play in so many different industries. Let's start on the PC market. The PC market had a tremendous period last year during the pandemic. What is your outlook for it this year?
Well, I think the PC market, as you said, had a tremendous year. I mean, you know, last year in 2021, as an industry, we shipped approximately 350 million units, which was amazing. We still see very strong demand coming in here in 2022, especially when you look at, commercial and high-end, consumer. We do expect that, some of the lower-end or education products may be a little bit softer, just given the strength in 2021. But overall, we see it as a strong year for PCs. And within that, we believe that AMD will perform very, very well, just given the strength of our product portfolio.
In the gaming console, you guys are a key player in all things gaming. Of course, looking right at that Sony PS5. When does that console cycle peak?
Well, when you look, if you look at the overall industry for consoles, first of all, this console cycle has been an amazing console cycle, very high demand, extremely strong products. What we see is that typically when you look at a console cycle, you would see the peak being sort of the year four, or which would be next year. We expect consoles to grow this year. We expect to continue to increase supply because there's very strong demand out there in the market. And, the overall environment, for our products continues to be very favorable. So, whether you're talking about, AMD's core markets of PCs, gaming, or data center, or Xilinx core markets, I think both companies have grown extremely well. And we look forward to 2022 being a very strong growth year for us.
And of course, Lisa, a lot of these gaming companies are playing right in the middle of the metaverse, whatever that might mean to certain people. Is the metaverse something that you are excited about, and how is AMD playing in it?
Yeah, I think, Brian, the metaverse is an opportunity. And, when I think about opportunities, I think about, which markets need high performance computing and, adaptive computing. And the metaverse is one of those. I see it as, sort of an extension of much of what we've been doing in the gaming world and really trying to bring more real-time capability. Again, you need CPUs, you need GPUs, you need adaptive SoCs in that market. We have a phenomenal IP portfolio, and we're working with some of the best customers or some of the most influential customers in the industry. So yes, I see it as a growth opportunity for us.
Well, speaking of growth too, since the last time we spoke, there's been a lot of inflation everywhere you look. Inflation, inflation, inflation. How concerned are you about just inflation in the global economy right now?
Yeah, I mean, Brian, I think we all watch those macroeconomic signals, and we want to ensure that, we understand and are very agile in what comes out. I will say in the semiconductor industry, though, what we're seeing is, just very strong demand. And I mean, you've seen that across the semiconductor peers. I think what we're seeing is more than just market demand, but we're also seeing strong preference for AMD products. And so we appreciate that. Much of what we've been doing over the last year and into the first half of this year is ensuring that we're ramping up supply so that we can continue to service all of that customer demand. And so that's, part of the growth that we see. And there are some investments that are necessary so that we can support that. So we're very focused on ensuring that we're watching, all of the global signals. But from what we see, it's a strong year for the semiconductor industry and a very, very strong year for the combination of AMD and Xilinx.
And the chip shortage, Lisa, is that likely to end at some point this year? Give us a target.
Well, I've always said, Brian, that there's tremendous investment that's happening across the semiconductor industry, whether you're talking about on the wafer side or on some of the substrates or the back-end assets. So we are making progress. I do believe that the first half of this year will continue to be quite tight. But the second half of this year, I think things will get a little bit better. I think we're very focused on ensuring that we work with our customers. So we're now planning, multi-quarter, multi-year with our customers, which just makes for a much more efficient supply chain. And frankly, one of the benefits of being a larger company for the combined AMD plus Xilinx is, we also hope to use that scale to ensure that, we get more than our fair share of capacity and support in the industry.
Lisa, I remember when you were first appointed CEO of AMD several years ago. Now, it feels like yesterday, but it's not. What is it like to pull the trigger on a deal that is the largest in this company's history? Have you had any time to reflect on it?
Well, I will say, Brian, it's a phenomenal feeling to be able to bring together such amazing teams. And, you know, as the largest deal in AMD's history, it's actually the largest deal in the semiconductor industry. I think there are lots of expectations. We hope to, you know, meet and exceed those expectations. But I will say that, you know, we have had a chance to spend a lot of time together. I've had a chance to spend a lot of time with Victor Peng, the CEO of Xilinx, will now become president of our adaptive and embedded computing group. There's a phenomenal team that is coming over with the acquisition. The teams have great chemistry and culture. And, you know, together we're focused on innovations and product strength and serving our customers and making sure that we make the industry a better place. So, yeah, it feels wonderful.
All right. Well, good luck in front of your presentation or your presentation to those 5,000 Xilinx employees. I know the road was long to get this deal closed. AMD CEO, Dr. Lisa Su, good to see you. We'll talk to you soon. So I want to welcome in Sheila Warren, who's the new CEO of the Crypto Council for Innovation. Sheila, good to see you here, and congrats on the new position. You just heard Jen talking about this settlement here. How do you think this will help shape future crypto regulation?
Well, I want to spotlight, I think, what Commissioner Peirce was saying to Jen, which is that we are seeing a lot of lead by enforcement going on here. In this case, there was a very specific response that was taken with BlockFi. And I got to be honest, I don't really see those particulars being something that extends across the entire industry. So that really is how where BlockFi wound up. But BlockFi was already in a particular place with particular kinds of centralization model that it was using that doesn't really apply to a lot of decentralized exchanges. So I think it's a little bit of a one-off in a way, and I don't necessarily see it as something that portends what's coming for, you know, the rest of all the exchanges in this space.
Hey there, Jennifer here. I'm curious to see what your reaction is from the industry standpoint, because SEC officials and Chair Gensler have been very fervent that crypto exchanges need to come in. They need to register proactively with the SEC. And it seems that officials were really trying to use this as an example to get firms to come in and register. Do you see that happening? How do you see the industry responding overall to this action?
So again, I think the industry is open to doing what clearly needs to be done. And I think, again, as Commissioner Peirce noted, it's not clear what needs to be done. I don't really see the BlockFi settlement as changing that reality. There are just aspects of the way that BlockFi operates that differ. It's not a pro or con. There's just different ways that these things run and operate, and not everything about the BlockFi parameters applies across the entire industry. So I think you've got an industry that is ready, if not eager, to understand the rules of the road, but is also very eager and standing very firm on the fact that rules that operate and made sense in a previous environment, or you could argue the current environment, don't really make sense in this new world of decentralized exchanges. There are just things that are important and interesting to preserve in the way that open permissions protocols run, in the way that DeFi operates, that would be lost if we treated it like something that has come before. So I see this as, again, a very targeted response to a particular situation. I think it does indicate, and I do take it as the SEC saying, look, we're going to come almost, if we have to go case by case, maybe we will. If that means we're going enforcement action by enforcement action, maybe that's what's coming for us. My hope, echoing again, Commissioner Peirce, is that that will not be the approach that's taken, that ultimately there will be something that is in more productive collaboration with industry around what the response ought to look like and how we can ensure that this activity is safe for consumers, because that's, of course, what everybody wants at the end of the day.
Sheila, it's Julie here. So what is your top priority at the council in terms of policy? What do you think is most urgent to get done now from a policy and regulatory perspective?
You know, it's such a great question, Julie, but it's really fundamentally education. And I don't mean to be punting, but there's so much misunderstanding. And the concern, I think, is that we are going to see either this piecemeal, you know, backdoor regulation that we're seeing in the examples we've been talking about through these enforcements, or we're going to see something that is regulating the wrong thing. You know, it's imagining that crypto is something that it really isn't, or it's imagining that crypto doesn't have the potential to be what those of us in the industry understand it can be. And so I would say it's really still just education to make sure that we are engaging in evidence-based advocacy to policymakers and regulators all around the world, so that when they do create these different rules of the road, they're doing so coming from a very informed position.
Sheila, you mentioned backdoor methods to regulating crypto, and certainly a number of folks have seen the current SEC proposal on the table with ATS that basically expands the definition of what an exchange could constitute as a backdoor way to regulate crypto. Your thoughts on that and where you see that proposal going?
Well, it's interesting, that proposal, because it's getting all kinds of fire from well beyond the crypto industry, right? It's really drawing flak from a lot of different places because it has implications of beyond crypto. But from the crypto industry perspective, I think that, yes, I think we do see it that way. We do see it as Commissioner Peirce, I think, warned all of us that it is something that is opening a door. I don't know that it goes directly at this, but it's opening a door to kind of bring in through this, I would argue, this kind of backdoor way, a lot of different kinds of entities that may maybe really ought not to be regulated in such a fashion and should be regulated more directly in a way that, again, acknowledges the innovation and benefits that they're bringing to the table. I think there's a reason that DeFi has emerged and blown up and gotten the traction it's gotten. And we need to kind of honor that and recognize that something was missing that now exists. So how do we make sure that we're looking at that thing and we're not killing that, what's exciting about it, killing the innovation in an attempt to bring it under the fold of something that, again, that's better understood. So I think that the ATS, this is going to get a lot of response from a lot of places, including from us. And we will stand together as an industry to just say, look, this is not the way to do this, right? That there's a better way of going about crafting the policy that is going to be protective of consumers, et cetera, and all these goals that I think are laudable and admirable goals. But let's do this in concert. Let's do it, again, recognizing where the innovation is providing benefits.
Sheila, there's an interesting conundrum that has sort of been, or paradox has been called out in the crypto industry to some extent. And that is the idea that this is DeFi, right? It's a very decentralized industry. And yet here you're at a lobbying body that's effectively backed by a couple of powerful firms. And that is something that's been called out, I feel, in the crypto world. So how do you sort of think about that, that this is something where everyone is supposed to have a stake, and yet it's still running through some pretty powerful players who are controlling a majority of it?
Well, I'd push back pretty hard on that last point, but let me start by saying, I hope that there's widespread recognition across the industry, and I think this is the case, that we really need all the talent and firepower we can bring to the table. We're in a very particular moment right now where the policies that are made around the world, not just here in the US and not just with the SEC, right, are going to shape the enabling environment and really determine the trajectory of this technology. Is it something that's going to thrive in a decentralized fashion? Is it something that's going to be captured and controlled and really forced to resemble legacy systems that really have not been serving a lot of people? Are we going to remain in kind of an exclusionary environment where only folks that have certain kinds of identification or have certain kinds of economic privilege can actually access financial services that will help them grow their wealth and better their lives? And I certainly think that's something we all would agree is not what we want to see. We want to see more people have more access to more services that can serve them and their families and communities. In terms of, you know, who's behind what, I think that there's a lot of value and having different players coming from different sides of the table that are all speaking the same message, which is, you know, crypto's here to stay. It's really important. It's a tool of empowerment. And then to kind of your last point that you made, I mean, I don't agree with that. I do think there's a difference between who might be deriving economic benefit and who's in control. Those are not the same thing. And it's important to recognize that. So here, I think that there's been a lot of support of decentralization as a concept in terms of who's got governance, who's actually making the decisions that are furthering different projects. And that remains very decentralized in our ecosystem, which is something that we want to see preserved here at CCI. And I would also speak on behalf of my members in stating that as well.
You know, and you talking about stakeholders and sort of spreading around the economic benefit brings up another question, which is, you're not only a woman, you're a woman of color who's in a leadership position now in the industry. And, you know, they're pick an industry where it's rare, unfortunately, and crypto is one of them, right? So how do you, we've been talking increasingly to women in the industry, but less so women of color. And so how do you think that needs to be worked on? I mean, again, pick an industry, but it, within crypto specifically.
Well, I would again pick an industry, right? It's this, it's kind of a sad reality today. You know, I would say that the premise of crypto is one of inclusion. It's why I'm in this space, and I think part of being a woman of color, part of being, you know, a mother, part of being a lot of things that are a little unusual, I think, in leadership positions in any industry, to be very visible with those kinds of qualities and personal circumstances. It brings a lot, I think, to the table, and I think that we need to be amplifying voices around the world of people who are engaging with crypto in different ways, who are not really focusing on speculation as a use case, who are really looking at how this is bettering their communities and their lives. I think for me, I've spent a lot of time abroad in my life, a lot of time in India, a lot of time working with communities of color, whether that's organizing or advocacy on a variety of different topics. And so I've seen firsthand really how empowering a technology like this can be and how empowering these opportunities can be, not just at an individual level, but at a family level and at a community level. And it's something that I take very seriously as a responsibility to keep talking about that and to make sure we're surfacing these concepts, that we're not just building something here to help a small percentage of people make a lot of money. We're building a tool here. We're building a system that is really going to provide, again, as I noted, this more inclusive environment, help empower women, help empower people of color, help empower historically underserved communities that have not been given access to legacy systems in ways that are meaningful, or have had to go through massive hurdles and barriers to really do the basic things like get a loan, get a mortgage, whatever it might be. So I think we need more and more of those voices everywhere, but certainly in crypto, because here, unlike many industries, we are literally building something that is, I believe, going to be a very critical tool for how we empower these communities, how we level the playing field, and create more inclusion. And so to me, surfacing those voices is only going to help make that case and help people understand that there's a lot more here than what maybe you're hearing traditionally in the media, or maybe what you're reading, you know, somewhere in some on Twitter or something like that. It's a much different pool of people that are working really hard.
Real good discussion here. Sheila Warren, the new CEO of the Crypto Council for Innovation. Good to see you. And thanks so much.
So a recent SEC filing, Charlie, showed Berkshire Hathaway bought almost $1 billion worth of shares in Activision Blizzard before the buyout by Microsoft. Do you like that investment?
Well, I don't pay much attention to that one, but I think gaming is here to stay, if that's what you're talking about. And I like Bobby Kotick a lot. I consider him one of the reasonable people in that field. And I don't think he personally tolerated a lot of crazy misbehavior either.
Want to broaden that out and ask you a little bit about technology, Charlie, because Warren often talks about understanding your circle of competence. And Berkshire, it's has stayed away from tech for the most part, but you've had investments, obviously, in Apple and Verizon, BYD and Amazon, with Greg Abel and Todd Combs and Ted Weschler at the helm. Tech is now about 45% of the portfolio. So is Berkshire shifting its strategy there?
Well, I think Warren and I have come to tech like some newborn infant that's dragged there. We've had to come because reality has dragged us there. That's true all over America. Tech is here to stay.
And Berkshire's biggest investment, Charlie, is in Apple. Do you expect Apple to continue to outperform other big tech stocks? And what's the future of Apple look like to you? You've got inflation, potential regulation, maybe potential headwinds like that.
Well, I think Apple is one of the strongest companies in the world. I judge the strength of the company based on how much the customers love it And I've got zillions of friends who they'd almost part with their right arm before they'd part with their iPhone. That's a hugely powerful position to be in. And I think Apple is one of the strong companies and will stay a strong company. And I think it's ungodly well managed.
Forbes has secured a $200 million investment from crypto platform Binance. The investment comes as Forbes eyes public markets in the first quarter via a SPAC transaction. Joining us now is Forbes CEO Mike Federle. Mike, good to see you again here. Big transaction for Forbes. Why are you making this deal?
Yeah, well, good to see you too, Brian. Well, it's part of our belief. You know, Forbes from the beginning has always been about giving people the knowledge, the resource, the inspiration, the connections they need to achieve success. And what's going on with digital assets, I call it beyond crypto, you know, with crypto, NFTs, blockchain technologies, the metaverse coming on. We want very much to be the guide to or the bridge to understanding as this comes on and starts to make even bigger impacts on society and business.
Hey, Mike, it's Julie here. I think it's undeniable, right, the interest that we are seeing in crypto broadly in society. We've certainly talked about it a lot. I have to ask, though, about the defamation lawsuit from Binance against Forbes a couple of years ago after you guys published some stories that were critical of the company. So how do you go from that to then this business relationship? And how do you have you guys sort of addressed that directly?
Yeah, so they withdrew that lawsuit rather quickly, I think, recognizing the error of it. But, you know, going forward, it was a great demonstration of the importance of editorial independence. And that is a cornerstone of Forbes brand. And any investor coming into, making an investment in Forbes knows that impinging upon that editorial, the journalism or the crossing that line is going to be a negative effect on their investment. So in some ways, it's actually strengthened an understanding of media from Binance and from the industry. But more than that, I think, again, we're going to continue to write stories that are pro and con from different points of view based on what we believe. So in the end, I think that was actually a sign of strength going forward.
And certainly there are a lot of various journalistic institutions that are owned by stakeholders who would have an interest in pushing coverage one way or the other. So to your point about journalistic independence, talk to me about the firewalls or what is sort of written into this deal to ensure that you guys are going to retain that independence.
Well, you know, I've gone through a lot of large investors, mergers, acquisitions over my career. And there have been various ways to deal with kind of creating defenses on the wall. I actually don't think any of those are necessary myself, in that it's a black and white situation and very clear as to editorial independence is the cornerstone of the value of the brand. And anyone coming into that, anyone, again, making that investment or anyone looking at acquisitions has to recognize that, you know, doing anything to damage that or to try to influence that negatively is going to be a negative effect on their investment. So for me, it's a simple problem that or a simple thing that doesn't really exist. We know it's not going to happen on my watch. It's not going to happen on Randall Lane or managing editor's watch. And it hasn't happened for 104 years. So we feel confident that there's no problem there.
Mike, how do you plan to use this money?
Well, the money is part of the overall de-SPAC, so and the SPAC process. So what we did, we've already used it, I should say, in the sense of we've traded out, when we first went out to raise the pipe on the SPAC, we had a target of about $175 million, and it was so oversubscribed, we capped it out at $400 million. What this investment does is allow us to actually take out some of the institutional investors in the original $400 million, strengthening it with the $200 million from a very strategic investor. And that's how we look at Binance as a very much strategic investor in achieving that kind of bridge I was talking about in terms of understanding and demystifying crypto and digital assets.
Lastly, Mike, too, there was it's my understanding that a competing firm, GSV, has stepped up here with an offer of pretty close to the valuation of the company with $620 million. Have you heard from them recently? And do you still see yourself being a public company in the first quarter?
Yeah, we're very much on track as a public company. I know the GSB guys very well. They're all friends. And it's all part of Forbes has had many, many different people, companies from around the world and interests from around the world about investing in Forbes, buying Forbes outright. We've chosen to go public via SPAC, in that it leaves us with the most cash to do the things that we want to do to really grow the enterprise, as we say, from, you know, to grow our business, which is relatively small compared to the giant outsized brand that is Forbes. So it leaves us with cash to do that, as well as no debt in the deal. So we chose this route, and we're on track to close the deal by the end of the first quarter.
Mike, as you know, the SPAC environment has gotten tougher. And the other well-known media company that's recently come public through a SPAC is BuzzFeed. We see the stock chart there. It has not been a pretty story there in terms of how it's reacted. Now, in terms of the SPAC that you guys are merging with, which is Magnum Opus, it's trading a little under $10. I'm just curious, like, given that environment, how you're thinking about when you guys are going public, you know, whether you need to brace yourself a little bit for that public market life.
Well, there's no doubt I have to brace myself for public market life. And SPACs, yes. I mean, it's no mystery that SPACs been going, people have been questioning SPACs. But I will tell you, we have some really strong indicators that, you know, we're very different than BuzzFeed. And you just need to look at both the underlying financials, which can all be found in the proxy statement, as well as our restatement of forecasts that we did in the third quarter. We are a very solid business right now. Significant revenue growth in the top line and big EBITDA growth on the bottom line. So we're already delivering a very good business, and the possibilities of growth in there, a lot of investors have seen. And now adding Binance as well, I think, is a big boost. And a good indicator of that is, you know, in our analyst day next week, we've got over 30 analysts signed up, which is a really terrific number for a micro cap coming out in the market for the first time. So there's a lot of momentum, a lot of buzz around it, and the markets will be the markets in the end, and we'll work with those as we see where the stock goes.
Well, good luck at that analyst day. We await your first day of public company life. Forbes CEO Mike Fairley, good to see you as always.
I mentioned inflation, Charlie, and the stock market is down a bit this year, maybe because of inflation, also the tensions in Russia and Ukraine. Maybe we'll get to that in a second. But I want to ask you specifically about inflation. Are we looking at a prolonged decline in the markets because of inflation? Is inflation on the rise, and should we be concerned about it?
Well, let me take that in the reverse order. Inflation is a very serious subject. You can argue it's the way democracies die. When democracy dies in Latin America, inflation is a big part of it. So it's a huge danger once you've got a populace that learns it can vote itself money. If you overdo it too much, you ruin your civilization a lot. And so, of course, it's a big long-range danger. If you look at the Roman Republic, and even after they went to an empire with an absolute ruler, they inflated the currency steadily for hundreds of years, and eventually the whole damn Roman Empire collapsed. So it's the biggest long-range danger we have, probably, apart from nuclear war.
Is it something investors need to be worried about, specifically when it comes to growth stocks right now?
Well, I think the safe assumption for an investor is that over the next 100 years, the currency is going to zero. That's my working hypothesis.
Wow. Well, that'll be a different type of environment, won't it?
A very dangerous environment.
And what about the Federal Reserve?
What brought in Hitler was the combination of the Weimar inflation, where they utterly destroyed the savings of the middle class in Germany, followed by the Great Depression. It was a 1-2 punch. And Hitler came in, crazy demagogue, with 40% of the votes, and pretty soon we had a dictator hell-bent for world war. So the history is not pleasant. And Germany was a very advanced and civilized nation, the Germany that Hitler took over. I always say that the interesting thing about that was little Albert Einstein, a little Jewish boy, got his entire primary education with the insistence of the Catholic Church in Germany. Now, that is a very civilized nation. So if you let your nation deteriorate too much, what you get is a Hitler. We've proved it.
Going back to inflation specifically, though, Charlie, do you think the Federal Reserve is doing the right thing now or not?
Well, of course, in a modern democracy in the age of Keynes, you're going to get big government reaction. The reaction this time was bigger than it's ever been before in the history of the United States. They just threw money at the problem. And they were probably right to fear what was going to happen and to be quite liberal in throwing money at it, but they probably overdid it a little. They threw so much money so fast that it's hard for the restaurants to get people to do the work. But I don't criticize it. It's hard to make these decisions under pressure.
How concerned are you about Russia and Ukraine right now?
Well, of course, nobody likes it. Of course I don't like it.
But is it a big concern?
Does anybody like the trouble? I don't think Russia likes it. I don't think it's good for anybody.
All right, well, let's shift gears and just get a bigger picture of exactly what's going on with the Russia-Ukraine situation. Obviously, a lot of developments just over the past few days over whether or not there would be an impending invasion sometime tomorrow. But of course, Olaf Scholz from Germany going over to Kiev, going over to Moscow. There's a lot to unpack. So let's bring in an expert who can speak to the politics of all of this. Michael O'Hanlon over at the Brookings Institution is the Philip H. Knight Chair in Defense and Strategy. Michael, it's really great to have you on the show. We've been talking about the market implications of all of this, but I feel like it's really helpful for our viewers just to back up and get to the root of the issue here, which really concerns Ukraine and whether or not they will or want membership in NATO. Give us just kind of the 32,000 feet in the air review of exactly what's at stake here, what the problem is, and whether or not the de-escalation that we're hearing about today is ultimately optimistic to you as well.
Well, thank you for having me on. And to start with the last point, don't take anything that's happening today as to the bank. I think the idea that markets are assuming war yesterday and peace today is verging on silly. Putin is good at trying to make us think whatever he thinks is useful for him. And so if he thinks that today a little bit of diffusing tension maybe makes us more inclined to try diplomacy, because yesterday we thought war was inevitable, so why bother? That's the kind of thing he would do. So I don't presume in any way, shape, or form that this thing is becoming less tense. Having said that, I think Putin's smart enough to know that war is a huge gamble and cost for him in military as well as economic terms. And I still would bet against him doing it if he can get some concessions. He's gone so far that I think he needs something. So to get to your more fundamental question, as you know, NATO was set up in 1949 to deal with the Soviet threat. But once the Soviet threat was gone, we doubled its size anyway over the next quarter century. And we included ultimately the three Baltic states, which had been part of the Soviet Union. We also included countries like Poland and Romania that had been part of the Warsaw Pact. And what really got Putin's goat is he watched all this and didn't like it, but put up with it. What he really didn't like was when Ukraine and Georgia were promised NATO membership back in 2008. This sort of came about as part of President Bush's so-called freedom agenda. He and Secretary Rice were really pushing democracy promotion, partly to give a better veneer to the Iraq War, but also more generally to try to reform the Middle East. And, you know, it's a noble goal. Nothing wrong with promoting democracy if you do it right. The problem here is that by promising membership to Ukraine and Georgia someday, but with no interim security guarantee, we essentially painted bullseyes on their backs because Russia knew we would not bring them in as long as they were unstable and as long as they had border conflicts with their neighbors, even if it was Russia that was causing the conflict. So ever since, we've seen various efforts by Russia to make sure these two countries stay unstable. And in the last 1 to 1.5 years, President Putin appears to have developed a real antipathy against President Zelensky of Ukraine. Zelensky started talking about wanting to expedite membership for Ukraine into NATO. He wasn't being offered that, but he raised the conversation, raised the topic publicly. And I think that, plus whatever else Putin perceives in terms of wanting to create a legacy, maybe wanting to do this when Biden's president rather than Trump, those kinds of issues could factor in here as well. But I think that the immediate, you know, impetus to this was Putin's growing contempt for President Zelensky and his concern that Ukraine was going to try to finally make real and make immediate what had only been promised in the abstract previously, the idea of Ukraine joining NATO.
Michael, you just highlighted some of the risks there in the case of, I mean, the worst case scenario here where Russia invades Ukraine. What would still motivate Vladimir Putin to move forward with that kind of plan, even in the face of that risk? Is it about regime change over in Ukraine?
It could well be. Yeah, that's a great question. I think it could well be. It could also be just taking part of Ukraine. As you know, he already took part of Crimea. The Russian Duma this week is considering whether to take that small province, the Donbas, over in the east and make that part of Russia. And so it could just be that Putin, who has said that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, that he's trying to put some of Humpty Dumpty back together, or at least the pro-Russian parts of Ukraine, basically from Kiev eastward. I'm not so sure they're pro-Russian anymore, but they historically have been closer to Russia than the Western parts. So that's possible. But I think your guess on regime change may be the closest to the mark if I had to try to figure it out. Because if Putin, you know, what Putin wants is a permanent agreement that Ukraine will not join NATO and that therefore it will be closer to Russia in general than it is to the West. I think that's his long game. And whatever he needs, if he could get a binding commitment from us never to offer Ukraine membership, that would be the best outcome for him. he actually wants to roll back some previous, you know, membership additions as well, which is not on the table. But if he could make the idea of Ukrainian membership go away permanently, that would be ideal. Next best is to get a government in Ukraine that has no interest in pursuing that, as well as the historical lesson to any future government of Ukraine that if you try to go down this path, you may suffer the same fate as President Zelensky. So yeah, I think that's a very plausible picture. I still think he prefers to see what he can get in this out of diplomacy and threats rather than the actual invasion. I think if he, you know, if he gets some kind of a diplomatic process that reduces the odds of Ukraine joining NATO, he's not going to be punished for this whole crisis in any meaningful way. He's essentially going to get a get out of jail free card, despite all the anxiety he's created. If he attacks and he kills people and he seizes land, then I think all bets are off as to where our economic punishment of Russia would extend. And I think he knows that.
Well, Michael, I mean, as a follow up here, it sounds like based off of the United States messaging, though, that they will not try to immediately balk to the demands for allowing Ukraine to get away from NATO here. I mean, what do you read from the State Department strategy, namely last week, with regards to putting it out there that they felt that an impending invasion was going to happen? Because one interpretation of that that I had seen was that this was the United States double dog daring Russia to not necessarily do the actual invasion, but to basically let them know that the United States had no intention of stepping aside here.
Yeah, you could be right. I don't totally have the motivation for the Biden team figured out. I'm not sure I agree with the sense of imminence that we've created in our prognostications. But I do think that you're certainly correct as well, that they've held firm to the so-called open door policy, which, by the way, is not really in the NATO treaty. There's nothing in the NATO treaty that says you must admit new members if they ask to join. You only do it, according to Article 10 of the NATO treaty, if you think it would improve European security. And I don't think bringing Ukraine into NATO is going to improve European security. So, but the Biden team disagrees with me, and so do most American foreign policy specialists of both parties. And so I think you're right. It's a delicate act. Even I would concede with my views, nonetheless, that you don't want to do this at the barrel of a gun. You don't want to somehow take NATO membership off the table at this moment. We would have been better off trying to negotiate a different arrangement before the threat rather than giving into the threat. So the best you can do now is start a process that is open-ended about where it might wind up. But Putin would know that if 30 NATO countries are involved in this process, and all 30 would have to bless a future invitation to Ukraine for it to be able to join NATO, that's a lot of countries that could prevent Ukraine from joining NATO if they believe that Russia has made a good faith effort to create an alternative successful security structure. So this is, you know, it gets hypothetical and it's provisional, but I think it's the best Putin can hope for. There may be ways that certain member states in NATO today, you know, President Macron or whomever, might sort of wink and nod that this could be possible, but only if we get to a certain place in the negotiation.
Michael, what does Russia's standoff with the West right now ultimately mean for its relationship with China? These two countries are not allies, but we have seen them get closer. We saw Vladimir Putin attend the opening ceremony over at the Beijing Olympics. They had a bilateral meeting before that. What does this all mean in terms of those two countries getting closer?
Yeah, and which, by the way, is a reason why, one more reason I was always skeptical that Putin was going to attack this week. I mean, people say that the Chinese don't care as much about these Olympics as the 2008 Olympics, but they still care. They still put tens of billions of dollars into the preparation. And if there's a war this week, it's going to slightly displace the Olympics from the headlines. But I think you're right that certainly China can provide a lot of the markets for Russian gas and oil exports that Western European countries now provide. And so if you imagine that we were going to reduce our, you know, we in the West are going to reduce our imports of Russian energy in the years to come, either as we go green or out of punishment for a Russian aggression against Ukraine, China could become an alternative market much more than it is right now. That's one piece. For China, however, it can't really get too far down this path of replacing, you know, a billion wealthy Western consumers with 135 million not so wealthy Russians. So there's only so far this relationship can go at satisfying both countries economically. But I think that strategically and diplomatically, even if they don't form an alliance and promise to fight for each other, they can do a lot of coordination. They can create crises at the same time to distract us and overload our circuits. They can protect each other's flanks at the UN Security Council. They can sally up to countries that we don't like and do it together, countries like Iran, where they can create a big headache for us and weaken us in that sense. So I think it's a pretty important partnership for both of them, and I would expect it to continue as such.
Michael Hanlon, it's great to have you on today to help us make sense of everything that's playing out in the region. He's with Brookings Institution, Philip H. Knight Chair in Defense and Strategy.